Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Happy Masters Week. We're recording the podcast Wednesday afternoon. All of the tournament preparations for the 89 competitors in this year's Masters are complete. Some players are finishing up their par 3 contest. Rex, you look like a limo driver, but how is your Masters Week?
It's been busy. I feel like a limo driver a little bit, but some people still think the Masters is an occasion. You look good there in your green shirt. I've been standing on the first fairway for about 8 hours now, but I appreciate you calling me out on that one. I'm not going to let you hijack the beginning of this podcast with all of your golf and Masters drivel and year's first major nonsense and Rory and John Rahm. We'll get to all that later. We need to get to the important stuff right now. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Ryan Labner's birthday today. Happy birthday, Ryan Labner.
Thank you. Happy 25th wedding anniversary to you and Bunk.
Big day. It's a big day.
I cannot think of anything better that you could have given her than peace and solitude on this very special day. I actually forgot it was my birthday until I got a morning FaceTime from my family. But yes, 37 years young. Actually, no better place to spend your birthday, just like your anniversary, than at the home of the Masters. Rex, it has been a busy few days since last we potted. We've been on the golf course 3 days, been doing plenty of hits, talking to plenty of players, walking the golf course plenty. What are your biggest takeaways to this point before we get into Masters Chairman Fred Ridley's press conference on Wednesday?
There's so much lead up to this event, and I'm just not even talking about this week. Clearly, you've been here since last Friday, I think, for the Augusta National Women's Amateur. I got here on Saturday, came out on Sunday, the drive, chip, and putt. It's a long week, just tournament-wise, just things you have to deal with. But more so, we've been thinking about this. We've been dreaming about this. We've been talking about this essentially since Brian Harman putted out at the Open Championship. I mean, it's the last time we really had all the top players in the game together for a major championship. And I think that's part of what makes Augusta National so special. We get here. We haven't seen these players all together in, what is it, 6 months? Maybe a little bit more than that. I'm not very good at math.
Longer than that, 9 months.
9 months. Thank you very much. So I think that's the part that kind of gets to you. At this point in the stage, and we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, you just want to see the first shots go in the air. And we're going to talk about the weather forecast, which is varying shades of awful for tomorrow. But all of the things that you look forward to is sort of what drives you up until this point. But personally, for me, I'm ready to see them start to play golf.
Yeah, I think we always get to that point. It's not quite as insufferable of a run-up as the Ryder Cup. To me, there is nothing that beats just the nonstop drivel and anticipation and useless projections than Ryder Cup week. But this is definitely a close rival. I think the anticipation, obviously, of 9 months between majors, this is the tournament that I think it's fair to say this is the tournament the players want to win the most. Certainly, American players want to win the most, not least because you get a green jacket for life and get to attend this tournament for life, if not play in it for life. And so all of those things come into it. Limited field, invitational, everyone's happy to be here. Sort of the pageantry of the event. But yeah, once you get to this point, mid-afternoon Wednesday, everyone wants to get the ball in the air. You did mention the forecast on Thursday, which is varying shades of awful. As of right now, actually, let's bring in Steve Burkowski, our Golf Channel expert, on the weather real quick. No. Oh, wait, that's a joke. We're not having Burko. He's not invited to live from, but if he were, he would have an absolute field day with the conditions. So they're forecasting right now, if you guys have been paying attention to the Weather Channel at all, there's like this severe line of storms. All I see on the Weather Channel downstairs are just tornado warnings, severe thunderstorm warnings. Basically, the entire southeast is in like the red cone of danger that is approaching the Augusta area, supposed to hit overnight and extend through. The latest forecast I saw was about 2 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. They're calling for 1 to 1.5 inches of rain. They're calling for damaging winds. We're talking sustained 30 to 35 with gusts from 45 to 50. And then, mercifully, it will blow out of here. And the remaining 3 days of the tournament look quite good. Friday will be a little bit gusty, wind gusts 25 to 30 miles an hour. But then on the weekend, supposed to be warmer, mid to upper 70s. And then Sunday looks to be about the same with actually some light breezes. So if there's any tournament, Rex, that can get through some of these weather difficulties, perhaps a delay to the opening round. It is the Masters, just 89 players in the field. They have broken the precedent to not go split tees a couple years ago in 2019 with Tiger's 2019 victory. So it would not be unprecedented to see split tees on Thursday to get them around. And with the cut with a low 15 ties plus 10 shot rule, it's really not going to be that big of an issue. It would just be a little bit of a bummer if the Masters does not begin on Thursday morning, but it is looking increasingly likely that that could be the case.
All right, pump the brakes on split tees. I don't think we're anywhere close to that. Let's hold off on that conversation. We're going to be doing mini pods after every round, so we'll have plenty of time to talk about what may or may not happen. I will tell you, I had to kind of pinch hit this morning for Damon Hack. He had to sort of move to a hosting role for Live From, so I moved to the first fairway, and I was doing the reporter role this morning, and I did probably three or four weather hits, essentially, kind of talking around certain things. And I can only imagine Berko at home just incensed with rage, just
screaming at the TV. Yeah. He's got two laptops up. He's running his models. He's running his forecasters. Right. He's got various meteorologists around the country projecting what could or couldn't happen.
Rex not talking about dew point at all. What's going on?
We joke. We do love Berko. We're hoping that this does not happen, but it does seem almost a virtual certainty. And I think based on what happened last year, remember the Saturday where you had a pretty severe wind gust come in, a couple of trees were felled near the 17th tee. I do think there will be, a level of caution exercise this year, certainly. So it would not be surprised, unfortunately, if the Masters get a delay. I think it would be a big bummer. I mean, you've walked the golf course these last couple of days. I was here even for the Augusta National Women's Amateur. I mean, the course is absolutely primo. That's nothing to be surprised at. Obviously, the conditioning of this place and its level of being manicured is second to none. But I think the firmness, the quickness, the fastness, the color of the greens, Masters veterans have said, you know, this place is as good as they've seen it in recent years. They can withstand, I would say, an inch of rain better than basically any course on the planet. But it would take a little bit of fire out of it and open up a field, I think, even a little bit more. Rex, let's transition to Masters Chairman Fred Ridley's press conference on Wednesday. You heard it in its entirety, about 45 minutes, his annual State of the Masters address. What was your biggest takeaway from that?
I anticipated him getting a couple questions about LIV golfers being in the field, some LIV golfers who aren't in the field. I think we're at that stage in the proceedings where, because of what's going on in professional golf, because the LIV events don't give world ranking points, we're going to reach a tipping point where I think right now, and I think he talked about the idea, they're comfortable with what the field is right now. Like, they don't have any issues. They don't feel like that someone got left out. Taylor Gooch, you can come at me. You can come at whoever you want. Augusta chose not to give you or any of the other LIV players outside of Joaquin Niemann a special invitation. That being said, the chairman was really, really quick saying that if there is someone that we feel deserves to be in the field, they always have that option. It's an invitational. They have an adjustable field. They try to keep it somewhere in that 90, 95 player range, but it's not written in stone. If they feel like someone's being left out, I truly believe this event, more than any other event in golf, has the flexibility to pull it off. The second half of the question, and he addressed many things that we're going to sort of touch on here. But the second half of the equation was carving out some sort of pathway for the LIV players. So we all know world ranking points is out of the equation, and it's not going to be too far in the future when we will reach that point that you and I and many others who have microphones will start talking about how is XYZ player not in the Masters. And yeah, okay, they're ranked outside the top 50 in the world, but we can all agree they are a top 50 player. It just has to do with the politics of the moment. And the chairman was specifically asked about maybe carving out some sort of exemption, whatever it is, say the top five players off the season ending points list for LIV. Clearly did not like that idea. Clearly is not comfortable with the idea. Kind of doubled down on what the world golf ranking, and he's on the board. We're talking about Fred Ridley for the official world golf ranking, that they feel like there's a pathway issue, that there, it's very much, I think his line was, closed shop. When it comes to LIV golf, that's what we sort of echoes what we heard about the world ranking points, and that they don't feel like they can legitimately compare to whatever it is going on over at LIV golf to what's going on every other tour that is in the ranking and does have essentially access to get into the Masters. So he didn't take a step closer to what we may or may not end up seeing in the future. But he certainly did leave open the option of they're going to make sure, they're going to try to make sure that they get the best field they can.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. We pulled out three news items from Masters Chairman Fred Ridley's press conference here. One was his thoughts on the rollback. Obviously, he supports it. He said that kind of the 8,000-yard mark of Augusta National is the line in the sand. He will never, under his watch, see a Masters played at longer than that. But it certainly seems like we're spiraling there without some action. He seemed to suggest, Rex, that the rollback that has been proposed for the elite amateurs in 2020, it probably does not go far enough. But at least it's a head start. And he said there's a couple things he'd like to see extra. We'll touch on his thoughts on a potential professional women's tournament here in a second. But you're right. The headline news for me was his thought. It's basically not ruling out extending a special invitation to LIV players if their performance does warrant it. But I did think it was interesting, Rex. And so he cited Joaquin Niemann as an example of the club's kind of flexibility extending a special invitation. But he did not, neither in the initial press conference announcing Joaquin Niemann's special exemption or again on Wednesday when he met with reporters, say anything about Joaquin Niemann's LIV performances and the fact that he has two victories so far this season. It was based strictly, at least in the press conference, based on his history in the Latin America Amateur Championship, which Joaquin Niemann won in 2018, as well as his willingness to play beyond the LIV season, go chase world ranking points in Australia, winning the Australian Open, playing well in a couple of other events on the DP World Tour. I think if you're looking at a player like Taylor Gooch, who is the best performing player on LIV Golf in 2023, top the order of merit points list, whatever you want to call it, if he wants to appeal to the Masters Committee for 2025, it certainly seems like he's going to have to go above and beyond just the traditional LIV schedule or be so extraordinary in those events that it would be obvious to anyone in the sport that he has to play. You know, winning three of the five events leading into the Masters. But again, those special exemptions are traditionally reserved for international players. But he said if players' performances warrant them, they do have the flexibility. And they would, I believe he said, not foreclose the possibility of extending invitations that way. I did think it was interesting, based largely on Augusta National being part of the OWGR board and denying LIV Golf's application. Like, he said that there were remedial suggestions regarding sort of pathways, access, the team golf component. It's pretty clear what Fred Ridley and by extension Augusta National thinks of the LIV Golf model and being a closed shop, and basically the only sort of relegation besides the four players at the end of the season is basically what new additions they bring in with significant signing bonuses. It does seem though, Rex, like there's a little bit of a softening that if you had rewound the tapes a couple years ago, it was quite clear what Fred really thought about this Saudi influence in the game and what the potential division of the PGA Tour and a separate tour meant. I do see a little bit of a softening of his stance, which I think is pretty universal now at this point. You saw Greg Norman out on the golf course. I don't know if you want to share that anecdote today. The Telegraph reported a couple days ago that LIV Golf officials will be invited to Augusta National. So it does seem like golf civil war is simmering down just a little bit.
I think so. Yeah, I saw Greg. I was on the first fairway, which is where I was doing the reports this morning for Live From, and he stopped and we had a really good conversation, probably talked for 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, nothing in depth. He said he was here just to support the LIV players. There's 13 of them in this week's field. And as he walked away, there was a telling comment about how he felt like this was important, that all of the top players are together again. Goes back to the idea that we haven't had this in 9 months. I would tend to agree with you that there does seem to be a softening of the tensions, at least between the major championships and LIV Golf. Certainly whatever's going on between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour, that seems to be a little bit different than LIV Golf. It doesn't seem like they're all on the same page, and I'm not quite sure when that's ever going to come around. But I think the chairman at least left open the idea that if Taylor Gooch were to your point, were to go the extra mile and to go play in a couple events in Australia or Singapore that do get world ranking points, even though it doesn't get him into the top 50, any kind of effort and any kind of performance is certainly going to be looked at and is going to be appreciated. That being said, this is the same guy who complained about not being in the U.S. Open and chose not to try to qualify for the U.S. Open. So I think this is, you have to take the entire package. You have to look at everything that he does with a grain of salt. Because I think had he tried to qualify for the U.S. Open and had he tried to qualify for the Open Championship, he probably would have been viewed in a different light, because he doesn't come across, at least in the context of should he get an invitation, should he not, he doesn't come across as a sympathetic figure in this situation.
I did think it was interesting too, Rex, with Masters Chairman Fred Ridley talking about the idea of the best players in the world competing more often and the major championships being elevated in stature because of the division, and it's great to have everyone back under one umbrella again. He said the Masters Tournament is not like the other major championships. The unique structure of the tournament with past champions, many of them, you know, past their prime and have no realistic shot of winning the Masters are invited until they're kind of either decide they don't want to play anymore, or it's gently suggested that they no longer play. I think there's seven amateurs in the field. Obviously, the amateur tradition of the Masters is pretty strong as well. And so the Masters never has the quote-unquote strongest or best field. Not all of the best players in the world are here, nor will they ever, just because of the neat structure of the tournament. But again, he said if the situation arises, they do have the flexibility to invite players. It'll be very interesting to see who, if any players from the LIV side are invited for next year. The qualification criteria for the 2025 Masters has not yet come out. The other thing, Rex, that I thought was interesting was his take on a professional women's tournament. I think the conversation has started to arise more and more. I think not just because of the success of the Augusta National Women's Amateur, which I've covered since its inception in 2019, and is obviously a great
weird
event.
Flex.
But the tour in play this season of Nelly Korda, who has now won four events in a row on the LPGA, the first time that's been done by an American since the 1970s, the first time overall since Lorena Ochoa in 2008. And I think just the recent spike in interest overall in women's sports. You and I were wrapped to our television over the weekend, yeah, watching Caitlin Clark in Iowa lose in the championship game to South Carolina. But the fact that for the first time ever, the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship outdrew quite significantly the NCAA Men's Basketball game was quite noteworthy. And so I think there's increasing momentum to say, hey, this is Augusta National. This is the biggest showcase in sports. Why not put a professional women's tournament at Augusta National? And Masters Chairman Fred Ridley's response was essentially, it's complicated. I think he described it as fundamental difficulties in doing so. One, the ANWA and the drive, chip, and putt are Saturday and Sunday, respectively, leading directly into Masters Week. But also, the club season is incredibly short. Augusta National closes for the summer, the third week of May, opens again in the fall. But as Ridley pointed out quite quickly, Augusta National does not play how they want to in the fall. We covered the November Masters in 2020 because of COVID. It was spectacular. I said at the time, if I never covered another Masters again, I would be content, because it was so magical being one of 500 people on property, hearing conversations, getting up close and personal. The foliage was absolutely amazing. Like that was still, I think, one of the highlights of my career was covering that tournament. But again, Dustin Johnson won with a tournament record score of 20 under par. Ridley said that he and DJ joked after the champions dinner on Tuesday, saying, yeah, I think that score is going to be safe for a very, very long time, just kind of owing to the difficulty of the golf course. Does this bum you, Rex, the fact that we won't see most likely a women's professional tournament? And do you think Augusta should do more, I guess, to support the elite women's game as they do the men?
I think that I appreciated the way that the question was asked, because, I mean, sometimes these questions, especially when it comes to the chairman, can come off as a little bit combative. It was not that. As you pointed out, it's kind of tagging on to the back end of what Iowa and the NCAA tournament did for women's basketball. And it was an amazing run, and we went well beyond just watching the final game. I think you and I have watched probably the last three or four of Caitlin Clark's games, I think, like most people in America, because you were captivated by that. It did not sound like there was much traction on that idea for all the logistical reasons that you just pointed out. And Augusta National, it's really easy to say, can do pretty much whatever they want to do. They turned a last minute November Masters into something that you just said was the highlight of your career. It was magical. So they certainly could, but it's not what they want to do. It is interesting because, look, once you're here this week, and this is the fun part about being at Augusta, there is no place in golf, maybe not any place in all of sports, where there's more rumors and, you know, ideas floating around as in what the club has in store next. Because they've always got something in store. As a matter of fact, he kind of glossed over, I guess there's going to be an underground parking area starting next year. There's
underground parking for players in 2025. Presumably, that is where in 2026, there's now going to be, he described it as a three-story building, basically like a hospitality lounge for players and their families, as if they're not sort of luxuriated over the course of the PGA Tour season and spoiled and pampered. It's going to go the next level beginning in 2026 for the players, which sounds amazing.
And he also talked at length, and look, this is kind of a local issue. They have a municipal course here. It's affectionately known as the Patch, and they've gotten very much involved with the foundation behind that, and they're clearly going to turn that into something special. They're bringing in Fazio and some other architects to redo it. They're going to redo the clubhouse. I can imagine a scenario. I say all this just to point out. I can imagine a scenario where Augusta National has access to multiple golf courses in the area, not just the Patch, but others. And they can find a way that if they really wanted to, they could have, I don't know, let's go back to last week and the LPGA and the match play event, where you can kind of rotate around, do like you do for the Augusta National Women's Amateur, and then play the final round on the golf course. I can see how they can work that in. But as you pointed out, like logistically, it's a really, really short season. They close, I think, the third week of May, and they don't open up until, I think, the second week of October. So they don't have a lot of time here to begin with. And once you start chipping away like they've already done, I don't think that's realistic, at least in the short term.
Yeah. And I still think there's sort of room for growth, particularly with the first two rounds of the Augusta National Women's Amateur. There are rumors flying around. Will Augusta kind of build its own golf course, where it will take a golf course locally over? Do they not like going the 25 or so minutes over to Champions Retreat and kind of bring it under the Augusta National banner? I could certainly see that. And there's also something to be said, Rex, for not overexposing Augusta National. The Master Chairman Fred really talked about the kind of the mystique and the magic of the place. And the more you make it accessible to the public, the more you put it on TV, the argument certainly could be made that some of that mystique and some of that magic dissipates even just slightly. You know, walking around the golf course early this afternoon, which I always do the day before the Masters, like this is essentially outdoor museum. It's a national park. Folks are just walking around. They're taking the scenes. They're taking pictures. They're eating sandwiches. They're lounging on the perfectly manicured turf. They're eating sandwiches. Like they're just loving life, drinking beers. Like it's just they just are just soaking in the experience. And I think if that's made more accessible, I think I can kind of see the point that it would just be reduced just a slightly in that sort of specialness. Sausage Finger up. Please go ahead.
Sausage Finger. And I did want to, it sounds like you're moving on from the chairman. I did just want to touch on the idea where he was specifically asked, let's take the new tee box on number two. I think it moved back about 10 yards, a little bit further to the left. I asked Roy about it last week. He feels like you're not going to change the shot that you hit going into that hole. I think he was asked specifically about the new tee box they put in a few years ago on 13, how that sort of has changed things. It was twofold. One, I did think it was funny. Like normally we're trying to read between the lines. Like the chairman's not going to come out and say, he's not going to come out and just drop this in a press conference. Next year, we're going to introduce a Masters golf ball, which is, you know, we've talked about this for a long time. That's not going to happen. That's not the way they do things at Augusta National. But from time to time, there will be a definitive moment where you're almost shocked by it. And today that moment was someone asked, I guess Vijay Singh had made a comment that the 12th tee should be moved back 10 yards. And to his credit, I think the chairman was taken a little bit aback by it.
He goes, I said that?
Yes. Yeah. He had to stop. Like,
BJ.
Let's be clear about this. And he said, and they don't do anything. I think he was asked, can you imagine ever when it comes to a women's event? Can you imagine there ever being a women's event? And his first reaction is, ever is a long time. Like, I don't know. I don't want to sit here and say forever. I really can't do that. But he did say when it came to the new quote unquote new tee box at 12, I can tell you with 100% certainty, it's not going to happen while I'm chairman.
I love it. It's the perfect hole. Even if they're now hitting pitching wedges or nine irons, depending on the wind, like, it's still
ask Jordan how easy that hole is. Come on.
Challenge. You and I both played that hole. Like, there's absolutely, I think it's the absolutely perfect golf hole, perfectly designed, and will always factor significantly into the ultimate champion in determining the outcome. I can imagine, Rex, the people at home saying, you idiots have spent 25 minutes talking about how the preparations have been undergone, the Masters Chairman's press conference. Will you idiots please just get to the favorites, players to watch, players you do not think will perform well? I think, Rex, we have to start with what I thought was a little bit of a surprise. The Masters, this is as close as you can possibly get to a supergroup. Barring a delay, at 10:42 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday, you will see world number one Scottie Scheffler. You will see Rory McIlroy, the world number two, and you will see Xander Schauffele, who a lot of people are pegging to capture his first major championship this week, and also inside the top 10 in the world ranking. Are you a little bit surprised to see those three players in the same group? And who do you think it helps? And who do you think it hurts?
I don't think it hurts any of them, to be honest with you, because it seems to me they all seem to be friendly enough. If they're not friends, then they're friendly enough. There's not going to be any tension above and beyond playing the first round of the Masters. I don't see that being a problem. You're at Augusta, so there was going to be big crowds. If Rory was paired with you and I, the crowds would still be massive because everyone is still there to watch Rory. So I don't think that's going to be that big of a difference. I will say logistically, and I have spoken with people here where they do try to sort of space all that out. And the idea being that because there's really no waves, you don't technically have a wave. You just have one wave of people heading out off the first tee. They try to not have groups, at least marquee groups, that close together. Because the way it's been described to me is if you do that, then what happens as those groups go around and the patrons are following that one group. And it was quoted to me, they're like locusts. They eat up everything, they drink up everything, they buy up everything they can get their hands on, and they keep moving on. So they try to space out those groups as much as possible. That surprises me a little bit, but I'm just going to touch on the first part. I can't imagine they tee off on time.
They're not going to tee off on time. But even if they go out at 3 o'clock, I think it could be absolute mayhem. Yeah. Anyone who has ever attended the Masters knows you cannot follow a group for all 18 holes. You know, it's not like you can just kind of plod your way around the golf course and watch every single shot. Like, it doesn't operate that way. But particularly for a super group like that, it could be absolute mayhem out there. I actually think, Rex, it's not going to hurt Scotty. It's not going to hurt Xander. I actually think it could help Rory McIlroy. When you look at his recent history, certainly over the past 5 years, what has really dogged him or plagued him has been slow starts. You look at his scoring average over the past five Masters, it's 73.8. And when you look at the history of this tournament and the fact that the past 18 Masters champions all have been T11 or better at the opening round, you can see where the struggles have been for Rory McIlroy. Essentially, when you look at those two stats, he's putting himself too far behind, is then playing catch up, and it is significantly reducing the likelihood that he will go on to win the Masters. The fact that he's playing with Scotty, who is on a different level right now, putting up ball striking numbers that we have not seen since Tiger Woods, I think can help. It also playing with Xander, who has played some phenomenal golf in 2024, despite not winning. I think it sort of sets down a marker for Rory to allow him to lock in. And I think Scotty's style of play is disciplined, it's patient, it takes advantage of the par fives, he scrambles well, he doesn't make sort of any silly or sloppy mistakes. That's exactly the sort of golf that Rory McIlroy is trying to play. You talked to him last week in San Antonio. He said he's trying to eliminate those boneheaded mistakes where you're like, what are you doing? Like, that's just an easy bogey. That's an easy double. Just play to the fat side and sort of add it up at the end, and all of a sudden you got a 68 or 69. I actually think it can help kind of riding alongside those two players who I think are playing the style of golf that Rory aspires to play, particularly at Augusta National.
I would agree with that. I mean, the way, all right, I'm going to go back and start this new. So it's Scottie Scheffler. We've already addressed this. Scottie Scheffler in his own tier and his own category, however you want to put
tier
it.
Tier one.
Tier one. And then everyone else behind him, I would say there's a pretty tight group of those who are 1B, let's call them. And I would put Xander in that group. I would put Rory in that group. I would certainly put the defending champion, John Rahm, in that group. As you start getting, and we had this conversation today on Live From, as you start getting further and further away from those, that 1A and 1B, that it becomes so much easier to start picking players apart. And I find that interesting. If it's easier to find a reason that you don't like this player, for whatever the case may be, not playing well, doesn't hit his irons well, doesn't have a good record here, doesn't like playing in the mud, whatever the case may be. If it's easier in that particular case, then you're probably going to end up with a field where there's only going to be 10 people who can compete. Because I was asked today specifically about Rory's chances. And if you were to take Rory's name out of it, and I would just throw his resume right in front of you and all the stats that we know and what we know about Augusta National, you'd be like, well, of course, that guy should be one of the favorites. Like, he's contended here before. He played well last week. It seems like he figured out the part of his game that's most important here at Augusta National and strokes gain approach. It's when you put the emotional baggage into it. Get rid of his name, and we're not even going to have a conversation about it. But you add the emotional baggage, and now all of a sudden, Rory's in that category of someone that, well, yeah, he should be able to do it. Tiger says he's going to do it one day, but
that did not help, correct? When Tiger Woods says flat out.
You don't think it helps?
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Quote unquote, no doubt that Rory will eventually complete the career Grand Slam. I'm sure Tiger was just trying to offer support, optimism for a player who he's grown close to over the past decade, but there is no way that did not unintentionally create even more pressure as Rory tries to, it is now 10th attempt to complete the career Grand Slam.
I don't know if Rory is wired the way you and I are. And by that, I mean, when we walk into the studio and they say, hey, you're going to do great. I know you are. Immediately, our minds go to, we're probably not going to happen. No. Like, I'm going to bomb. I can feel it.
Have you ever seen us before? Like, this right. is not going to go well.
Are you not paying attention? And I think that's where our mind goes. I don't know if Rory's does. I think the baggage of the place, his history here, probably weighs on him more than Tiger Woods sort of stepping up in a press conference and announcing Rory as the next champion. Because I don't know if he can have any more pressure. This goes to the idea of, every time we talk to someone who's trying to win for the first time or win a major for the first time, at some point you can only want something so much. Like, and Rory has wanted this for a long time. But is there a saturation point? Is there a point that he gets to where it's just kind of like, look, I can't keep putting myself through this. Like, either it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. And I go back to the idea that I will give him so much credit for what he's doing and not doing this time around, because he decided to reinvent the wheel. I'm going to start over and come up with a new blueprint. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But man, I think the pressure he feels is not external. I think it's all internal.
So what do you think of his strategy this week? He was the 89th and final player to register for the Masters. He didn't arrive into the Augusta area until about midday on Tuesday. Headed straight in for his pre-tournament news conference. No opening remarks, 7 questions. 13 minutes in and out, a very hasty exit.
Not that you were counting.
No. Just 9 holes on Tuesday, 9 holes on Wednesday, saying that he did most of his homework, most of his prep work in 2 practice rounds ahead of the Valero Texas Open last week. To me, this is just a guy who is trying to emulate what he does each and every week on the PGA Tour, where he flies in into town either late Monday or early Tuesday, does a little bit of work, cleans it up, and then goes and sees how he plays. Obviously, look at his record on the PGA Tour. I mean, he's the winningest player, win start percentage wise, of this generation. Do you think that strategy can actually apply now to the most pressurized environment that he's going to face all year?
This feels like you and I tinkering with rubs when we're cooking ribs or whatever. Like, because you hope you have it get it right, but very often I don't get it right. So I think, yes, I feel like he's on a good path. Only because everything else he's tried up to this point hasn't worked. So you might as well give something else a try. I remember a few years ago, he showed up the Saturday or even maybe the Friday before. Like, it was a ridiculous amount of
Jason Day model of,
yeah,
Jason Day's been grinding on the trimmer practice area since last week.
And of course you're going to wear yourself out. It's going to be overload. Like, it's, that's, I would imagine that one was probably easy to figure out. It wasn't going to work. The one thing that he touched on yesterday in that abbreviated press conference is he was kind of asked, what do you hope to take out of this week? And he sort of laughed and thought about it. And he goes, I want to enjoy myself, which is the simplest thing to do. And it sounds so odd when you say it. Like, you and I are making the rounds this week and talking to a lot of people who are coming to the Masters for the first time and never been here. And it's so hard to get across how it creates inside the bamboo, as they say, which is the property here. Inside the bamboo creates this vortex. Actually, the chairman said that last year. It's the first time I'd ever read it. Because, you know, the property surrounded by huge rows, hedges of bamboo. You know that, right?
Sure.
Okay. Anyway, once you're inside the bamboo, it creates this vortex, and it's really easy to get myopic and to not be able to see the forest for the trees and everything. And so in Rory's case, which you would think he would love every aspect of his life, I can imagine how the last decade or so at Augusta National has not been that enjoyable. So the idea of all of these different little things that he's doing differently are probably a step in the right direction. But I think the ultimate test, and you pointed out the obvious, like, he has to get off to not a great start, just a decent start, like, start even par, start one under, let's baby steps here, but just enjoy himself, because at some point you're just beating yourself up too much. Yeah. Right.
And I think
that's something going on in your eye there. What's
happening? Yeah, I'm getting very emotional. Okay. Just even thinking about a potential Rory McIlroy victory on Sunday. No, I have something in my eye and I cannot get it out. I do think, Rex, that last year Rory's performance was so jarring for him. Because if you think back to 2022, Rory shot 64 in the final round. Although he did not have a realistic shot to catch Scottie Scheffler, he at least thought on the second nine that, hey, you know, if I do something even more spectacular, I've got a very outside chance. He thought that was a big breakthrough for him, to show that he could actually do it. He goes then into 2023 feeling good about his game. He just had a good week at the match play. And then he comes here, has a great couple of days of practice. He was never more convinced that he was going to play well at Augusta National than that year. And what does he do? He shoots 77 in the second round and then misses the cut. To me, this is a huge year for him. Just validation-wise, he's playing well enough to win. Can he finally stumble upon a strategy that actually works? TBD. What do you think about Scotty? The refrain about Scotty this week has been, if he putts well, he's going to win by a gazillion. If he putts average, he's going to win by two or three. If he putts poorly, okay, now at least the rest of the field has a chance, and it could be one of the most wide-open Masters that we've seen in recent memory. Do you subscribe to that theory? Should we just crown Scotty Scheffler now, second green jacket in 3 years?
I'm going to let you deal with your pink eye, so I'll gas bag and delay a little bit here so you can clean up whatever's happening over there. Yes, I buy into that theory entirely, because we've seen it. Like, it's not what I think is going to happen. He has shown us that's what happened. At Bay Hill, when he putted well, he picked up 4.5 strokes on the field on Sunday, and he won by five. Like, you do the math. Like, that's the way it works out. You look at what he did at the Players' Championship. He putted okay. It wasn't great, but he putted okay, and he wins. You look at what he did in Houston. Didn't putt quite as well. Was right in contention until the very end. And yes, he missed the putt on the last hole that would have forced a playoff. So it's a pretty easy line to follow, even though I'm being a bit of a prisoner of the moment, simply because we know his ball striking. We know what that is. That's a very quantifiable element to all this. I don't know that anybody in the field is hitting the ball better than he is right now. We know how important that
is. No one is. We have empirical evidence to show that.
I was trying to couch it, and I probably didn't need to. So I appreciate your help on that one. Yes, no one in the game, no one on the planet Earth is hitting the golf ball better than he is right now. And we also know that's really, really important at Augusta National. Not a putting contest. It's a second shot golf course. Like, that's what you need to do well, and that's what he is excellent at. So I can imagine his confidence is through the roof. And again, average putting week, you have to not just like his chances, love his chances.
Rex, how about a couple other names, maybe the most intriguing players that you're looking forward to seeing over these next couple rounds? It could be as obvious as a John Rahm and Brooks Koepka, or maybe some under-the-radar players that you think actually have a realistic shot to win this thing.
I do like John, and we kind of talked about this early in the week, and we'll continue to talk about it. I've kind of moved on from the idea that we don't know what to expect. Well, John Rahm's a defending champion, and I feel like we do know what to expect. He may not win. I'm not declaring that right now, but I certainly will be shocked if he doesn't find a way to at least contend, because that's what he does. And that's what he does on LIV. That's what he did on the PGA Tour. He's not a different player. Brooks Koepka is a bit of an outlier on this because he hasn't played very well this year on LIV Golf, even though we have a hard time sort of wrapping our minds around whatever it means if you do or you don't. But as we know, like, he flips the switch. Whatever happens when he drives down Magnolia Lane and the other lanes heading into the other majors, he's just something in the way that brain is wired. He just decides, okay, this week I'm going to be serious. So either one of those guys, I think, would be right there in that second group. Let's call them 1B. There's a couple on the outskirts, like Jordan Spieth. Like, I mean, you just can't ignore it. I'm not sitting here telling you he's going to contend because I have no idea. We watched him last week. I mean, I interviewed him on Thursday. I interviewed him on Friday. He got emotional talking about sort of getting lost in the process. And
lost in the sauce, so to speak.
Yeah. Every tour player will tell you, you need to take the results out of anything you're trying to do. Like, if you've decided to go down a path, whatever that path may be, whether it's swing or chipping or putting or whatever the path may be, for at least the short term, you need to take the results out of that. You need to try to stick to the process and have some sort of faith that you're going to get to wherever it is you want to go. Last week in San Antonio, he had reached a tipping point. He was tired of getting lost in the process. He wanted to see some sort of results. If he can clean up those big misses, if he can clean up the big mistakes. On Thursday, he made a one on one hole and a seven on another hole and everything else in between. So the good stuff is there. If he can get rid of the bad stuff, he could definitely do it on this golf course where he's had success before. Either way, I'm here for all of it because no one is going to be more entertaining than he is.
Yeah, Jordan and Augusta are a love story. We absolutely cannot quit, nor should we, since he has six top four finishes at what is still a very young Masters career. He's just 30 years old. I'm obviously looking forward to seeing that one as well. Just to button up your other points, John Rahm, I thought it was very interesting. He spent some of his press conference on Tuesday sort of defending LIV's competitive aspects, whether it was the schedule, whether it was the competition, whether it was the team angle and sort of the pressure that he feels week in and week out. John Rahm, I think to the surprise of many, does not yet have a win in any of his five starts on LIV, although he's finished, I believe, in the top 13 in all of them. He said he is fresher, having played less golf. One thing he did not say, Rex, though, is that he is sharper. So I think it'd be very interesting to see how John Rahm plays as it pertains to Brooks Koepka. You mentioned it. I mean, he has not played well in 2024. Traditionally, he says once the calendar flips to March 1st, that's when he sort of locks in, except in the two events that LIV has played in 2024. He's finished outside the top 25 in both of them. Is that going to matter? It may not. I mean, we've never seen a player, at least in this generation, quite like Brooks Koepka, who can be so middling and so pedestrian for long stretches of time. And then when you get into a tournament that actually matters, that's when he flips on a switch. You know, Brandel made a great point that Rory seems to play his best when the least is at stake and his worst when the most is at stake. Brooks Koepka, historically, over the past decade, has basically done the opposite of that. And now he has five major championships to show for it. I think this will be the ultimate acid test of whether form matters as it relates to Brooks Koepka. I would throw, Rex, a couple other names out there. I'm very interested to see how this rookie class performs. And you could make the argument that this is the best rookie class, best first-timers class that we've ever seen at the Masters. Wyndham Clark, the reigning U.S. Open champion, the world number four, is the highest-ranked player ever to be making his Masters debut, coming off a couple of really nice weeks during the Florida swing, including at the Players' Championship, where he finished just shy of the playoff. But you also throw Ludvig Åberg, a top 10 player making his Masters debut. You think about Nikolai Højgaard, who has already played on a European Ryder Cup team. Akshay Bhatia, who just won last week in San Antonio, assuming, of course, he does not dislocate his shoulder once more with one of those tiny little fist bumps. So I'm curious to see. We have not seen a Masters rookie win since 1979. But as Wyndham Clark said earlier this week in his press conference, those are the exact type of records that are made to be broken. Jordan Spieth, of course, in 2014 came awfully close, finishing T2.
I haven't looked up, and there has to be some sort of line or some sort of bet on this, but I would tend to agree with you. I don't know if it's the best rookie class ever. Like, that's tough for me to quantify. I'd like to
see top 10 players making their debut. I mean, when has that ever happened?
I don't know that it has. I don't think so, ever. We have a crack research department. I'm sure they'll be all over that after they listen to this podcast just to find out. I will say that, well, two of those players, Wyndham, certainly, because Wyndham has established himself as just not the guy that won the U.S. Open, just not the guy that won the Wells Fargo last year, just not the guy who won Pebble Beach. Like, he's going to be a regular. He's going.
Think about what happens, Rex. What if Wyndham Clark wins this Masters? He would now have a U.S. Open title, a Masters title, and two signature event wins, plus two runner-up finishes in signature events. All of a sudden, the narrative of, oh, this is going to be Scottie Scheffler's era in men's professional golf, I mean, Wyndham Clark would have a better resume over the past 12 months than Scottie Scheffler. I think it'd be indisputable.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, I don't want to gloss over the Players' Championship, but yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think the bigger issue with when it comes to Wyndham Clark is he clearly doesn't own a mirror. Because whoever decided to tell him, and you're colorblind, I don't expect you to be part of this conversation.
Even I can say that was an outrageous look.
Could you see it?
I didn't know what colors they were, per se. But I could see that they were loud and slightly obnoxious. But hey, this is a big week for scripting.
And I want to go down the rabbit hole because you got a little mad earlier than week because someone said something about the tie you had on. I believe it was Monday, was it not?
It was Monday. Yeah, I came out strong. Again, I'm colorblind, and for those who do not know anything about colorblind people, I see life in color. What I struggle with is the shading. If you've never taken a colorblind test, I encourage everyone to Google it. It's essentially like there's a three on a page and you throw a bunch of colors on there. Able-bodied people can pull up three quite easily. Colorblind people cannot see the three. And so I know I do not dress myself. My lovely wife, Amy, does. And so she has coordinated all my outfits. I know what days I'm supposed to wear them. And so I have not picked out my clothes ever. I've never shot for myself since I have been married or engaged or dating her for the past 15 years. So any sort of hate that you're directing at me
is flying
right over my head.
I'm not doing that. I want to give Bonnie Ball 2937 at Bonnie Ball 2937 a shout out. She said you looked very handsome. I assume this was on Monday when we were all making fun of you about your tie. And she said she's old enough to be your mom, so she wasn't trying to flirt with you at all. Right. And she liked the suit and the tie combination. There were plenty of people who did not, including the director of the Live From show we were on. I think his comment right before we came up was, that the tie he's going to wear? That's you never want to hear that right before you're about to go on live TV.
Bonnie, I do appreciate the love. I do also appreciate that my demographic ranges from 36-year-old women like my wife all the way to Bonnie, who apparently is the same age as my mother. I do appreciate the support, Bonnie. If people thought that tie, and it was certainly polarizing, I don't think it was skewed.
That's a nice way of saying it.
towards disliking it. I don't think it was universally loved either.
Say that.
That's nothing.
Some people said that.
That is nothing compared to what I got cooking up for these next 4 days.
All right. My boy Cook.
Viewers, be forewarned. Rex, give me your winner. Give me your top player who you think can also place. I don't know what that means. Does placing, I'm not a gambler. Does that mean top three? Does that mean top five? How about just throw out a winner, a player you think will contend, and a wild card of sorts for people who are filling out their Masters pools at home?
I can do this. I think Scottie's going to win. Like, I have a tremendous amount of confidence. I think Rory McIlroy and John Rahm are going to contend. And it's going to be one of
the limb you're on. You're going to take
No. I'm about to take a step.
Really?
I'm about to take a step off
the top
three
players in the world are going to contend for this match.
Yes, one, two, and
Bravo.
Three.
Bravo.
I love
done.
Chalk. No one likes chalk better than me, but you're going to love this. And I had thought this through all day long because I had tried to make an argument to you that Brian Harman should be the quote unquote dark horse. And we always struggle with this. We always bicker back and forth about what qualifies as a dark horse and what does not. He's the 10th ranked player in the world. I get what you're coming
from. The reigning Open champion is not a dark horse.
Reigning Open champion.
I'm sorry.
Not a dark horse.
He's the world number eight.
World number eight. Apologies. Sorry, man. I will say this, though. Who I'm going for, the one you would not expect, not a bulldog. Give me some Russell Henley.
I like it. I think he has four consecutive
top 15s.
Of course,
you like it. He went to Georgia.
I believe he has four consecutive top 15 finishes. I may be wrong there, but iron play is one of the strengths of his game. I'm with you, Rex. I think Scottie Scheffler is going to win this golf tournament, and I think it could be somewhat decisively. 2, 3, 4 shots would not surprise me at all. For my player who I think will contend, I think there's a lot of them. But I think Xander Schauffele is the obvious one to me. I think we could be looking at another Players Championship rehash. For sort of the dark horse player, so to speak, I don't know if the world number 12 and a former Masters champion is a dark horse, but I do think Hideki Matsuyama will continue to play well this week. I like Russell Henley as well. Jordan Spieth, I like him as well.
How about gonna name everyone in the field? Is that what we're doing now?
How about Will Zalatoris? Rex has played in the final group of this tournament before. You look at his putting stats from regular PGA Tour events and major championships, which are traditionally on greens that are faster and more on-hitting, is a stark difference. I talked to him earlier this week about his putting, which had a little bit of a setback with his broomstick putting. He said he's trying to get more artistic. There is no golf course in the world that favors and rewards artistry, imagination, and creativity quite like Augusta National. And so I do like him as well. Corey Connors, three top 10 finishes in his past four appearances. If Corey Connors wins this Masters tournament, Rex, I will allow you to write that game story. Anything else that you'd like to share with the people before we wrap up this official Masters preview?
No, we're going to be doing mini pods, and so we'll keep you up to date. Clearly, tomorrow is probably going to be a long, wet, cold day. I think they will play a little bit of golf tomorrow, and it will be interesting. We talked about this on Live From. If we get the amount of rain that they're forecast, which is about 1.5 inches, is in the forecast. And look, no golf course in the world can handle that much amount of rain like Augusta National. So I don't think it's going to be an issue, a prolonged issue. But if we do get that much rain, I think all of the names that you just rattle off, and it seems like you rattle off about half the field when I asked you who, that number is going to constrict. Like if it's going to be wet for the foreseeable future, that is going to make the Bombers, the guys that we just touched on, it's going to make the
basically
Scottie
last Shepherd, year. Look at last year's tournament.
Yep,
you had some separation.
And Brooks and anyone else who can knock the cover off the ball, it's only going to make that much more important.
I always feel a little bit nostalgic as we sit here on the eve of the Masters, Rex, because it's like sort of like NASCAR, where this is golf Super Bowl, and you could make the argument quite pessimistically that the golf season only gets worse after this week, right? Like this is the high point, and it just comes fast and furious, and you're just trying to hang on, and the storylines aren't quite as coalesced as they are as we sit here.
April, you're going dark already. Why are you going so dark? Yeah. It's April.
Because I love this tournament. I love to cover it. I think it's fantastic. There's so much anticipation. It just feels, you just want to savor this moment, Rex, because as soon as the ball goes in the air, it could be at 8 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday, or it could be about 3 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday when the Masters actually begins. It just seems like it goes so fast. And so we have the Golf Writers Association of America dinner on Wednesday night, and then it's all downhill quite quickly from here. I just want to take a moment to savor this because it will be underway before we know it. But yes, we will be back on Thursday night. Could be a late mini pod edition of the Golf Channel podcast with Brexit Lab, depending if we do have some weather in the area, probably when we do have some weather in the area. But you guys know the drill. In the meantime, go to golfchannel.com or nbcsports.com/golf for our latest news, updates, commentary, features. There you can find my Victor Hovland feature, both on TV and online. Love doing that. Earlier this week, Rex, you and I will be on Live From for the rest of the week. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll be back in 24 hours from now to recap probably the midway point, first round. From now.